From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We have provided in the text a clear humanitarian exemption for the sanctions, and we've designed the text as we've circulated it to go after North Korea's programs of weapons of mass destruction.
The UN Security Council is debating action against North Korea over claims it carried out its first ever nuclear test. North Korea warned today increased U.S. pressure would be considered an act of war. Then a melee at Columbia University. An onstage brawl breaks out when student demonstrators at Columbia disrupt a speech by Jim Gilchrist, founder of the anti-immigrant group, the Minutemen Project. We'll host a debate between Gilchrist and the chair of the Chicano Caucus at Columbia. Then misadventures in corporate media. The founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Jeff Cohen, joins us to talk about his new book, Cable News Confidential. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A new medical study says the number of Iraqi deaths since the U.S.-led invasion has reached more than 655,000. The study was carried out by many of the same researchers behind the Johns Hopkins University survey that put the death toll at 100,000 2 years ago. Researchers based their findings on interviews with a random sampling of households taken in clusters across Iraq. The newest survey yielded the same estimate of immediate post-invasion deaths as the first one. Attacks from U.S.-led coalition forces accounted for 30% of the reported deaths. The actual number of dead could be higher. The 655,000 figure represents an estimate of excess deaths, people who wouldn't have died had the U.S. not invaded. The study's already coming under criticism. Anthony Cordesman, an analyst with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, says the researchers are playing politics ahead of the November midterm elections. In response, University of Michigan professor and Middle East scholar Juan Cole writes, quote, "Is he saying that 18,000 households from all over Iraq conspired to lie to Johns Hopkins University researchers for the purpose of defeating Republicans in U.S. elections this November?" In other news, North Korea's warning increased U.S. pressure over its reported nuclear test would be considered an act of war and could lead to further tests. In a statement Wednesday, the North Korean Foreign Ministry said it's already, quote, for both dialogue and confrontation. The warning comes as the United Nations Security Council continues to debate a draft resolution of sanctions proposed by the U.S. The U.S. wants sanctions under Chapter 7 of the U.N. Charter, which means they would be mandatory and ultimately enforceable by military means. This is U.N. Ambassador John Bolton.
We have provided in the text a clear humanitarian exemption for the sanctions, and we've designed the text as we've circulated it to go after North Korea's programs of weapons of mass destruction.
China has reportedly canceled leave for troops along part of its border with North Korea, and South Korean forces have been ordered to stay on high alert. We'll have more on the North Korea nuclear crisis after headlines. In Mexico, leaders of a group of striking teachers say they've reached a tentative agreement that could end a lengthy standoff with the government. Under the deal, the state would remove blockades from Oaxaca's downtown and raise teacher salaries for the first time in 6 years. The protesters have reportedly dropped a key demand for the immediate resignation of State Governor Ulises Ruiz. A spokesperson for the teachers said they'll continue to seek Ruiz's departure even if his resignation does not come as part of an agreement. In Moscow, thousands of people gathered Tuesday for the funeral of the journalist and human rights advocate Anna Politkovskaya. She was shot dead as she returned home to her apartment Saturday. She was a fierce critic of President Vladimir Putin and the Chechen War. This is an unidentified mourner.
Of course, we are experiencing limitless grief. I think this is the main sensation we are feeling now. Such a character she was. Anna Politkovskaya could be called a conscience of the nation. Maybe later we would be able to say more, but now we are just very sorry for this person.
The murder has brought international condemnation and renewed scrutiny on freedom of the press in Russia. Many believe Politkovskaya was killed for her outspoken opposition to President Vladimir Putin. On Tuesday, Putin dismissed her political activity as a motive in the killing.
I would like to underscore that whoever committed this crime, and whatever their motives, we should assess this crime, repulsive by its nature. Certainly, it should not remain unpunished. The motives could be very different. Indeed, this journalist was a sharp critic of the current power in Russia, but journalists should understand and experts know that the level of her influence on political life in the country was insignificant. She was more known in media circles and in human rights circles in the West, but I repeat that the influence on the political life in the country was minimal.
Back in Iraq, a massive fire at a U.S. ammunition depot in Baghdad is still smoldering today following a mortar attack from insurgent groups. The bombing set off a series of explosions from tank and artillery shells that could be heard for several miles. No injuries were reported. This news from Darfur. The UN's top human rights official is calling for an investigation into Sudan's role in a series of attacks that may have killed several hundred people since August. The attacks have targeted some 47 villages in Darfur. Witnesses have described massive looting and indiscriminate shooting by raiding militias. On Tuesday, UN Human Rights Commissioner Louise Arbour said Sudanese officials almost certainly had prior knowledge of the attacks. In India, a new law barring child labor has gone into effect. The law bans children from working in restaurants, hotels, resorts, and private homes. The official number of child laborers in India is 12 million, but it's estimated to be as high as 60 million. This is Bihar State Deputy Sushil Modi.
The people need to be sensitized to the fact that the new law against child labor is in force now. This will raise awareness that employing a child under 14 years of age, whether it be as a domestic help or as a help in roadside eateries, is a punishable offense and will attract penalties and other legal actions.
Critics of the bill say it will not solve the problem of child labor and want the government to take a more active role in reducing poverty. Here in the United States, Republican House Speaker Dennis Hastert continues to face questions over his handling of the Mark Foley scandal. Hastert has been scrutinized over when he and his staff first heard allegations of Foley's inappropriate contact with congressional pages. On Tuesday, Hastert was quick to deflect the attention onto his staff.
They'll be under oath, and we'll find out. If they did cover something up, then they should not continue their, to have their jobs. But I didn't think anybody at any time in my office did anything wrong. I found out about these revelations last Friday. That was the first information that I had about it.
A U.S. military lawyer is accusing the Pentagon of a massive cover-up in an investigation that cleared soldiers of abusing the Guantanamo detainee David Hicks. Hicks is an Australian citizen who was captured in Afghanistan over 4 years ago. His attorney, Major Michael Morey, says investigators ignored evidence, including corroborating testimony from four Guantanamo prisoners. Hicks has alleged he was regularly beaten by guards at the prison and by U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. In Seattle, a U.S. appeals court has upheld the finding of a man who delivered medicines to Iraq while it was under a U.S.-led embargo. On Tuesday, the court ruled the government was right to fine Bert Sachs more than $13,000 for making the trips. Sachs visited Iraq 9 times starting in 1996, delivering medicines banned under sanctions overseen by Britain and the United States. And finally, in Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair's government has won a motion to hold a secret trial for two men accused of leaking a memo detailing a conversation in which President Bush reportedly says he wants to bomb the headquarters of the Arabic television network Al Jazeera in Doha. The memo was revealed a year ago next month. David Keogh, a former civil servant, and Leo O'Connor, a former parliamentary researcher, are charged with leaking the memo in violation of the Official Secrets Act. On Monday, a British judge sided with the government's argument that publicly disclosing the memo's contents would harm British national security because it would have a, quote, detrimental impact on diplomatic and political relations with the U.S. Mark Stevens, the chief lawyer for Al Jazeera, said, quote, the bottom line is that there is no national security involvement in the case. What's being protected from us is evidence of a war crime, he said. The secret trial is expected to start in April. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. North Korea has warned increased U.S. pressure over its reported nuclear tests will be considered an act of war and could lead to further tests. In a statement carried by the state news agency Wednesday, the North Korean Foreign Ministry also said North Korea is, quote, ready for both dialogue and confrontation. The move comes as the United Nations Security Council is due to continue debating a draft resolution of sanctions proposed by the United States. There is agreement in the Security Council, including from Russia and China, that North Korea should face punitive measures. The U.S. wants the sanctions to be brought under Chapter 7 of the U.N. Charter, which means they would be mandatory and ultimately enforceable by military means. But China, Russia, and South Korea have expressed varying degrees of opposition to such a resolution. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said Tuesday the U.S. did not intend to invade or attack North Korea, but she warned the North's leaders that they now risk sanctions, quote, unlike anything that they have faced before. Meanwhile, in Beijing, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Liu Jianchao outlined China's position.
From the perspective of China, we are firmly opposed to war as a means to resolve the nuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. This is our firm position. It is known to the whole international community. And for the second question, China has been long dedicated to good neighborly and friendly relations with North Korea. We don't need to deny that the nuclear test by North Korea has a negative impact on our relations with them. And we hope North Korea will give a positive response to the appeal of the international community and honor its commitment to denuclearization and refrain from any act that may worsen the situation.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Liu Jianchao. China has reportedly canceled leave for troops along part of its border with North Korea, and South Korean forces have been ordered to stay on high alert. North Korea announced Monday that it had carried out its first ever nuclear test, triggering global condemnation. Japan, the United States, and South Korea are still trying to verify that the test was genuine. Only Russia has said the evidence available confirms a nuclear blast actually occurred. Bruce Cummings is a professor of history at the University of Chicago. He's the author of several books on North Korea, his latest, North Korea, Another Country, and Inventing the Axis, the Evil. He joins us in the studio from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Can you start off by talking about whether you believe North Korea did set off a nuclear bomb, test a nuclear bomb?
I really don't know. They announced in advance that they were going to conduct a nuclear test, which makes them the first nation in history to do that. All other countries have blown off a nuclear weapon. You know, we found out about it the next morning. So I think North Korea had to be in a position of assuring themselves that some kind of explosion would take place. It could be high explosives combined with nuclear material. It might be a small plutonium bomb of about half a kiloton. We just don't really know, but it wouldn't surprise me if it wasn't really, you know, the plutonium bomb that everybody's talking about.
And what is the significance of this, the timing of this? Were you yourself, as an expert on Korea, were you surprised?
Well, I think people have been predicting that North Korea would make an atomic test for about 15 years now, so it isn't surprising that they eventually went ahead with it. But I think what this represents is 15 years of failure on the part of the United States and the non-proliferation regime. We nearly had a war in 1994, which forced the United States to negotiate directly with North Korea. We had the Framework Agreement in 1994, which froze their plutonium reactor, kept it frozen for 8 years. That was a great success, but the U.S. didn't hold up its side of the bargain to go ahead and normalize relations with North Korea, to provide light water reactors as a substitute for the plutonium reactors, and eventually the North Koreans decided that we weren't holding the agreement up, upholding the agreement, And they started a second enriched uranium program thanks to AQ Khan from Pakistan. That was a failure. But the worst failure has occurred in the Bush administration, where you have people inside that administration that can't decide whether they want to overthrow North Korea or negotiate with North Korea. So they have essentially moved on two tracks with no consensus, and the president has not asserted himself to have a uniform policy. And now, after 5 years of this, North Korea has gone on its own to detonate a nuclear device, and we're really back to square zero.
What I think is astounding for some is the enormous pressure and attention right now on Iran that many say does not have weapons of mass destruction or a nuclear bomb. And yet North Korea clearly further along, if not having one bomb, may have a number of bombs. But the same pressure has not been applied.
It's important to understand that North Korea is a garrison state with a million men under arms. It has another several million who have served for long periods of time in the military. It's been sanctioned since 1950 when the Korean War began. It's been isolated by the United States since the regime was formed in 1948. They're used to outside pressure. They've lived with it. And they can continue to live with it. The sanctions will not make a difference with this regime. Even if China were to cut off its aid, it's not going to fall. So we have to negotiate with it.
Can you talk about what's happening right now at the United Nations?
Well, John Bolton wants to move to Chapter 7 sanctions, which would have, would be backed up by military force eventually. And North Korea has said that would constitute an act of war. That puts us right back to where we were in 1993 and 94 when the U.S. was pushing the Security Council to do something about North Korea's plutonium program. And China and Russia resisted. They will resist any hint of military force, and so I don't think we're going to get Chapter 7 sanctions. I do think, though, that Mr. Bolton represents a point of view within the administration that the U.S. may go ahead and sanction North Korea regardless of what the U.N. does, possibly blockading their ports and things like that, which will be dangerous. As I said earlier, the only way to resolve this situation is through direct talks between the United States and North Korea.
Professor Cummings, you just mentioned how AQ Khan had gotten nuclear material to North Korea. 3 years ago, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh revealed that Pakistan was helping North Korea build the bomb. Hersh reported the CIA had concluded that Pakistan had shared sophisticated technology, warhead design information, and weapons testing data with the Pyongyang regime. But according to Hersh, the Bush administration sat on the CIA report because the White House didn't want to divert the focus from Saddam Hussein, and Pakistan had become a vital ally in Bush's war on terror.
Well, I think Seymour Hersh is right. Pakistan did have a nuclear Walmart for North Korea, Iran, and Libya, other countries. We did not punish Pakistan in any way for this, even though they were the worst proliferators by far in the world. And the Bush administration, when it came in 2000, was presented during the transition by Clinton administration officials with intelligence that North Korea had begun importing enriched uranium technologies from Pakistan. And they sat on it for 18 months until the preemptive doctrine was announced in September 2002. James Kelly then went to Pyongyang the following month in October of 02 and confronted the North Koreans with this evidence of a second nuclear program. And the North Koreans, as they almost always do when confronted with their backs to the wall, said, fine, you know, we have it, we'll see you later. And they proceeded to kick out UN inspectors that had been on the ground for 8 years, remove themselves from the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and reopen their reactors. Furthermore, they got control of 8,000 fuel rods that had been encased in concrete for 8 years, and that probably is the plutonium that would be at the basis of this bomb test. So this was a complete and utter failure because North Korea paid no penalty for jumping out of the NPT again. getting back their reactors. And the Bush administration continued to essentially argue inside the administration about whether to topple the regime or try and negotiate with it.
So yes.
It was really quite a remarkable failure. And North Korea, let alone Pakistan, neither one of them until now has really paid much of a price for this.
Yesterday, Arizona Senator John McCain gave a speech in Detroit. And he said, I would remind Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton and other critics of the Bush administration policies that the framework agreement of the Clinton administration was a failure. Explain what that framework agreement was.
Well, it was an agreement that came after a very dire threat of war in 1994 that froze their entire plutonium facility at Yongbyon in North Korea. They had seals on the doors, closed-circuit television, and at least two UN inspectors on the ground 24/7 all the time. So there isn't any possibility of that agreement having failed. It held for 8 years and denied North Korea the plutonium that would have allowed them to make more bombs. Senator McCain is engaged in some sort of demagoguery here. Because I don't know a single expert who would say that that framework agreement was not successful, at least for 8 years, in keeping North Korea's plutonium facility shut down. Now, the enriched uranium program is not even clearly a program for a bomb. It may be to enrich uranium for light water reactors that were expected to have been built by the United States and its allies. But even if it is for a bomb, it's much more difficult to enrich uranium to weapons grade and create a uranium bomb than it is to create a plutonium bomb. Plus, they already have now, thanks to the Bush administration's policies, the wherewithal for 6 to 8 plutonium bombs. So in effect, they don't even need the other program. People say North Korea cheated. Wow, isn't that really terrible? Kim Jong-il cheated. I don't know anyone who thinks that Kim Jong-il is a person who can be trusted, but I do know that North Korea kept that agreement made in 1994, and the U.S. did not. We pledged ourselves to normalize relations with North Korea. We didn't do that. We pledged ourselves to build light water reactors. They got started in 2002. So when you actually look at that agreement between country X and country Y, rather than the endlessly demonized North Korean regime, you see that we are responsible as well as the North Koreans for the current situation. But as far as Senator McCain is concerned, he's just flat wrong. It's not a partisan question. It's a question of knowing what that agreement was and whether it was carried out or not.
Bruce Cummings, right now the North Korean government, Kim Jong-il, is saying that if even further sanctions are imposed, they would consider it an act of war. Can you tell us who Kim Jong-il is, and what do you make of that?
Well, Kim Jong-il, of course, is the son of Kim Il-sung. He's 64 years old. He was brought up alongside his father from the Korean War onward to be the successor to his father in a very sort of Korean traditional manner. When you look at South Korean conglomerate firms like Hyundai, they do the same thing. The eldest son succeeds the father. Now, this may not be communism, it may be some form of feudalism, but it's very Korean. And Kim Jong-il certainly doesn't have the charisma of his father, but he's very smart, he's well-informed, and he's been at the center of power since about 1970. We're talking 35 years. So he is a formidable individual, but much more than that, he is backed by a phalanx of hundreds and hundreds of leaders at the top of that regime that worked with Kim Il-sung. About 6 years ago, the top 40 leaders, top 40 leaders, only one was under 60 years old, and that happened to be Kim Jong-il. So you have a kind of geriatric leadership with children of the leaders in their 40s and 50s and 60s running the place. And they are not going to bend to the United States or collapse or change just because we want them to. I must say that every time I turn on CNN, which I like as a channel, what do I see? A story on North Korea and goose-stepping soldiers come into view, and the goose-stepping soldiers stay there as if this is a Nazi regime. The goose step was done by almost all the communist regimes. It predates Hitler. It's not very edifying, but it is the case that we live in a democratic society where an attempt to get some sort of nuanced view of North Korea is almost impossible. You have to search for it in the fine print of our very best newspapers. So I think it's, let me just say that we have to know our enemy. If this is our enemy, we have to know it. And people in Washington have constantly underestimated, mischaracterized Kim Jong-il and the North Korean regime, and we're paying the price for it. These people want to normalize relations with us. After 60 years since we divided Korea in 1945, it seems to me that talking to them and normalizing relations is the only way to solve this problem. And what's so terrible about having an embassy in Pyongyang? We have embassies all over the world with countries we don't like.
Bruce Cummings, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Professor at the University of Chicago, joining us from the University of Michigan and Ann Arbor today. Among his books, North Korea, Another Country, and Inventing the Axis of Evil. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. Weird Library of Art here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting in over 500 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM, college and community radio stations, also on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. The anti-immigration group, the Minuteman Project, announced yesterday they're seeking to strip Columbia University of federal funding for what they say are violations of their civil rights. Last week, student demonstrators disrupted a speech by Minuteman founder Jim Gilchrist. He was invited to the school by the college Republicans.
The Minuteman Project.
Over 20 students stormed the stage after Gilchrist came to the microphone, and two students unfurled a banner reading, "No human being is illegal." On Friday, Columbia University President Lee Bollinger issued a statement that read in part, quote, "The disruption on Wednesday night that resulted in the termination of an event organized by the Columbia College Republicans in Lerner Hall represents, in my judgment, one of the most serious breaches of academic faith that can occur in a university such as ours." Bollinger has vowed to launch an investigation into the students' actions, but at a news conference Monday, the students claim that they were assaulted. They point to a video taken by a reporter from Univision. They say it depicts a member of the Minutemen kicking a student in the head. Well, Jim Gilchrist, who is the speaker at the event, joins us now from Irvine, California. He's the founder of the Minutemen Project and the co-author of Minutemen, The Battle to Secure America's Borders. Here in studio in New York, I'm joined by Karina Garcia. She's the political chair of the Chicano Caucus at Columbia University. Her group organized the protest outside the Minutemen event. We asked a representative from Columbia University to join us as well, but they declined our invitation. Let's start with Jim Gilchrist. Can you talk about why you came to Columbia and what your message was?
Yes, thanks for having me on your program. We came to Columbia from the invitation of the Republican Club, student club at Columbia University, to speak about the book that Dr. Corsi and I wrote. Dr. Corsi also was scheduled to speak right after I was, and also about our views on the illegal immigration crisis that the United States is facing. We were there simply to disseminate information, not engage in what we've been accused of as some kind of xenophobic racism. It's simply a lecture presented by three of us. Marvin Stewart, an African-American member of my board of directors, Dr. Jerome Corsi, and myself.
And when you got to the university and you were giving your address, what is your view of what happened?
There was a concerted effort to forever shut down the First Amendment by those who disagreed with our what we were going to talk about. This is not something new. It's something that's been attempted in the past by other either student groups or anarchist groups. The International Socialist Organization, whose goal is to stamp out free speech if they do not agree with it. So this is not something new. I didn't expect a storming of the stage, although it didn't surprise me, because I had mentioned earlier to security that they should have uniformed badge-carrying officers in front of the stage to deter something like that from happening. It's a shame what happened. It'll go down in history forever as a day of infamy in Columbia University's annals.
Karina Garcia, your perspective on what happened and where were you?
Sure, thank you for having me. It's ridiculous for them to have turned it around and said that it's an issue of free speech. What we actually saw was was two groups exercising their right to freedom of speech. One group was promoting hatred and violence, and the other group was loudly opposing it. We never asked for the university, or for anybody for that matter, to ban this man from speaking. He was able to reserve a hall in our auditorium. He had the security of the New York City Police Department. He had the security of Columbia University Public Safety. Nobody attacked Mr. Gilchrist. As a matter of fact, if you look at what his comment was the very next day on Fox News, he laughed about the situation and said that he was ready to give the very first Minuteman knuckle sandwich, which just goes to show how this man wasn't attacked at all. As a matter of fact, we were the ones that were attacked when we went up to unfurl a banner that said, say no to racism. And it was our right and our duty and our obligation to stand up on the stage and say, this man is a murderer, this man is a racist, and we do not support him.
And what then happened when people went up on the stage?
When we went up on the stage, we were attacked by the Minutemen, as is evident in the Univision coverage.
And your response to the president of your university, Lee Bollinger's statement on Friday?
I think that he was feeling a lot of pressure from the right-wing media, Fox News, Bill O'Reilly, going on TV when the university is in the middle of a capital campaign and telling donors to stop giving money to the university, them turning this into a free speech issue, which it was not. I think that he was feeling a lot of pressure to react and react quickly without actually seeing the evidence. And I think that if you look at his statement now, I think it's a lot different once the Univision coverage was shown. And then it showed who really were the people who were attacked and who were the aggressors in the situation.
Outright propaganda. Jim Gilchrist, your response.
Yes, I'm going to end this interview until for the outcome of, based on legal advice. What this lady is doing is putting a complete spin to her advantage. I've never murdered anybody. I've never engaged in violence. I've never encouraged any violence or racism, nor has anyone in the Minuteman Project. This was a covert, a concerted, premeditated effort by people like Ms. Garcia to stifle
and
the First Amendment.
What about your ties
now,
to the National Alliance?
I'm going to end this now, and you can deal with the law firm that's going to probably name you and your cohorts as defendants. I'm going to have to end this now based on advice from legal counsel. I'm sorry.
Go ahead and run away.
Jim Gilchrist, I'm puzzled. Are you sitting there with a lawyer?
That's it.
We have just been cut off from our contact with Jim Gilchrist, who is in a studio in Irvine, California. Says he had legal counsel to stop talking. Jim Gilchrist, the founder of the Minuteman Project and author of the book Minutemen. Karina Garcia, your response?
He's a coward. He's very tough when he has a shotgun and he's in the middle of a desert intimidating defenseless immigrant families. But when it comes to being challenged by peaceful protesters and by people who understand this man and this organization for what they are, he runs away. And I think that was evident right now.
What was your comment about the National Alliance?
It's a known fact. This group recruits people from the National Alliance, one of the biggest neo-Nazi organizations in this country. This is an undisputed fact. Now, the fact that this organization is trying to clean up its image now, the fact that Jim Gilchrist has taken off his Klan hood and put on a suit, doesn't mean that he isn't what he is and that his organization isn't what they are. David Duke took off his hood too. He tried to run for governor of Louisiana and he put on a suit. And does that change the person that he is, what he represents? Not one bit. What he represents in the Mexican community is the same thing, what the Minutemen represent in the Mexican community is the same thing that David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan represent for the African American community.
I'm sorry we couldn't carry on a dialogue, a discussion with you and Jim Gilchrist, but it was the College Republicans at Columbia who invited Gilchrist there. Have you had a discussion with them?
No.
And what has been the response on campus of the protest?
It's been mixed. We've gotten a lot of support from people, but after the terrible coverage that we got from Fox, from the right wing, who mobilized very quickly to turn this into a free speech issue, which is clearly was not. People are mixed up. They don't understand exactly what happened. And then that's why we held our press conference on Monday to say exactly what happened. We didn't attack that man. We didn't attack them at all. And the video coverage shows just that.
Did the speech continue after you stood up with your signs that said no human being is illegal?
No. And that is not because this man felt physically threatened. This is because he was in the midst of a crowd of more than 150 people who were chanting when we got up on that stage and held our banner. And they were saying, "Si se pudo, si se pudo." And he felt isolated because the entire time the crowd was against them because they saw what they are. They know what they've done. And he terminated his own speech when he left. And that was not because he was threatened, like I said, but it was because he felt isolated and because he knew that he couldn't win. Because we knew exactly who he was. And so do the millions of undocumented immigrants in this country who didn't have the ability to be in that room to call this man what he was.
Was there a difference between the English language press coverage and Univision's coverage?
Oh my God. Wow, there's a world of difference between the two. I mean, if you saw what they showed on Univision, it showed that we were attacked. And if you see what they showed on everything else, it was that this group of angry Mexicans just run up on stage. And really, all they show is just like the tugging of a banner, which really isn't violent at all. I mean, nobody was attacking anybody in that situation, but they were quick to sell the narrative that we had we couldn't control ourselves and that we attacked these people. And if you think about what Mayor Bloomberg went on to say, all of a sudden he's become the advocate of a free speech, and he's tried to like jump on it and make himself the free speech advocate. Now, if you think back 2 years ago, when the Republican National Convention was in New York City, he wasn't allowing people protest permits so that they can protest against the war and against the Republican National Convention. This is coming from the same man. So I think that it's important that we look at that and we remember who we're talking about. Now, the fact that they want to silence students, like they're not promoting free speech. What they want is a pristine environment where racists and fascists can promote their agenda and their propaganda without challenge. That's what they're asking for.
Why is this issue so important to you, Karina?
The issue of immigration, the issue of
the issue of immigration. The issue of the Minuteman spokesperson coming to and founder coming to Columbia.
This isn't an organization with ideas. These are people with guns. These are people with rifles. People that stand on the border in the middle of the desert and they declare open hunting season on defenseless immigrant families. This isn't a battle of ideas. Their immigration policy, and I can quote their members, is it should be legal to shoot illegals. Just shoot them on sight. That's my immigration policy. That's their connections with the National Alliance, their connections with people like Barbara Koh, who have said that Latinos and Central Americans, they're a bunch of savages. The fact of the matter is, you can't tell a documented person from an undocumented person. You can't. They can't. So many people have died, so many people have been tortured, so many people have been left to die in the desert because of this organization and because of the racism and the hatred that they promote and that they spread. So when they came to our university, we were speaking to a larger crowd, not just the people in the audience who were already against them. We were speaking to the country, to other students, and saying, this organization is a racist organization. They commit violent acts against innocent people. Wherever they go, they should be challenged.
And your response to the Minuteman Project announcing they're seeking to strip Columbia University of federal funding for what they say are violations of their civil rights?
That goes to show what they're trying to do. They're not advocating for free speech. They want to create an environment where they're not challenged, where nobody stands up and speaks out against them. That's what they want to do. That's why Michael Bloomberg went on television and said his speech about free speech, not because he's a proponent of free speech, because that was clear 2 years ago when he wasn't allowing people to protest against the war.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Karina Garcia, political chair of the Chicano Caucus at Columbia University. She is a senior at Columbia. And I'm sorry Jim Gilchrist left in the midst of the program. It would have been an interesting dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
The government has now banned the carrying of spears.
Stop about every 1,000 miles, ain't asking too much, is it?
You might wish to stay on and listen.
It was a place where everything was legal.
I met this woman.
So if you're looking for emotional satisfaction, my advice to you is seek professional help.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One Nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are United States of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching. TV is the reason why less than 10% of our nation reads books daily. Why most people think Central America means Kansas. Socialism means un-American, and apartheid is a new headache remedy. Absorbed in its world, it's so hard to find us. It shapes our minds the most. Maybe the mother of our nation should remind us that we're sitting too close to to the television. The drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV is a stomping ground for political candidates. Where bears in the world.
Television, drug of a nation, disposable heroes of hypocrisy. Michael Franti. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A new study by the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, criticizes PBS's flagship news program, The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. The study finds that NewsHour interviewed many more male sources than female, that people of color made up 15% of U.S. sources. Fair also found on the issue of Iraq, NewsHour interviewed five times as many guests who advocated staying the course over withdrawing troops. Well, in his new book, Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, media critic Jeff Cohen dissects the cable news channels and also finds serious failures in covering the most urgent issues of the day. Jeff is the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, though not with them anymore. He has been the co-host of CNN's Crossfire, a weekly panelist on Fox News Watch, and a daily commentator on MSNBC. He joins me in the Firehouse studio now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with me. First, talk about Cable News Confidential, your experiences in the media and how it relates to the climate of today.
I live to tell about it. I was inside as deep as a progressive media critic has ever gotten. And what I found at places like CNN and MSNBC, the number one fear among the working reporters, the producers, is of doing anything that could get them or their channel accused of being liberal. And I saw the spectrum that's constructed, the spectrum of debate is center to right. And, you know, people blame that on Fox News, you know, Hannity and Combs, a phony GE to GM spectrum. But it was really CNN and PBS that invented that years before there was a Fox News. So in the book, I describe how that gets constructed and why almost half of the political spectrum is kept out of political debates on a regular basis on TV news, especially cable.
Explain how it happens. And you were also a producer for Donahue, for the Phil Donahue show.
Well, we were trying to change the situation at Donahue. But I mean, the people that run TV, they have a corporate view. Their idea of balance is to get a conservative Republican to debate a conservative Democrat. For years on Crossfire, the host was Michael Kinsley of the New Republic. And every night he announced, I'm Michael Kinsley from the left. After doing that for 6 years, he gave up his seat, and that's when they tested me to be the co-host. And a reporter asked Kinsley, after 6 years, what are your politics? And he described himself as a wishy-washy moderate. And that's typical. When I was tested for the show, I was co-hosting with Bob Novak, Crossfire. And I asked Novak, you know, settle this for me, Bob. Who's further, during commercial break, who's further right, you or Pat Buchanan? And he starts railing about Buchanan being a liberal New Dealer on economics. He said, look, I was an Eisenhower Republican in the 50s. I've moved further right every year since. And, you know, look at who represents the left on TV. It would never be someone who said I was a Kennedy Democrat in the 60s and have moved further left every year since. It's just unheard of. So they construct a situation where it's center right, and by having the center represent the left, they don't have to worry about corporate sponsor flight. They don't have to worry about corporations being attacked in a serious way. When I was tested for the CNN Crossfire job, that was a concern of theirs, that I would be criticizing the nightly sponsor. There's no doubt they made it explicit to me. And then, you know, when we were trying to redress this problem on MSNBC years later, I'm the senior producer at the Donahue show, and the war starts coming. And management, you know, we have to remember, Fair has always talked about how these media outlets are strict corporate hierarchies and the powers at the top. Well, it's theoretical until you're on the inside and it happens to you. And in the last months of Donahue, we were ordered by management at MSNBC. Every time we booked one guest who was anti-war, we had to book two that were pro-war. If we booked two guests on the left, we had to book three on the right. At one meeting, a producer suggested booking Michael Moore and was told for ideological balance, she would need three right-wingers. And, you know, I used to think about proposing Chomsky as a guest, but our stage couldn't accommodate the 38 right-wingers we would have needed for balance. I mean, when you see this kind of suppression, when we would talk about booking Scott Ritter, one of the most articulate dissenters, a skeptic of the WMD evidence, because we had a steady parade of weapons experts that got everything wrong, and they were unrebutted. on MSNBC, I was a pundit. I couldn't discuss the weather without being balanced by at least one fire-breathing right-winger. But the weapons experts got on all by themselves, and everything they said was wrong. And we tried to book Scott Ritter, and it was like clockwork. We'd hear in the building at MSNBC, oh, we hear he's getting covert funds from the government of Saddam Hussein. It was completely false, a smear aimed at getting an articulate dissenting voice off of mainstream TV. I'm sure it wasn't just being heard at MSNBC, it was being heard at other channels. And the irony is, I learned years later that one of the experts, one of the advocates I was always debating on MSNBC was, in fact, a recipient of covert government funds. The covert government funder was the Bush administration. I'm talking about Armstrong Williams, who got all that money to push No Child Left Behind. No one invited me into the No Pundit Left Behind program. So yeah, I mean, the spectrum that I saw on TV is enforced. There's always exceptions. I was at Fox News on weekends every week for 5 years. There's always exceptions to the rule. But the rule is a general parade of a narrow center-right GE to GM spectrum.
And then, of course, Donahue was forced off the air. Was it because his show was failing ratings?
Well, think about it. When his show was taken off the air 3 weeks before the Iraq invasion began, it was the most watched program on the channel. And it's very rare in TV news where the most watched program, or TV, where a most watched program gets canceled. And, you know, the day after Donahue was terminated, that memo leaked out. It was never supposed to get public. An NBC internal memo about MSNBC. It said Donahue represents a difficult public face for NBC in a time of war. He seems to delight in presenting guests who are anti-war, anti-Bush, and skeptical of the administration's motives, unquote. What they really worried about is we tried to get dissenters on there that would say, you know, this might not be about weapons. This impending invasion might be about oil or military bases or empire. And to question motives is almost a cardinal rule. To say that the motives of U.S. foreign policy might not be pure, that's not something they want. And, you know, that NBC internal memo that leaked a day after Donahue was terminated, it went on to describe their nightmare scenario. Donahue would become a home for the liberal anti-war agenda, I'm quoting, at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity, unquote. Now, I know what you were doing in that period, and I know what independent journalists were trying to do, which was ask the tough questions before our young men and women are sent to kill or be killed overseas. They wouldn't let us do it. And they wanted us waving flags. And what I saw inside the mainstream at MSNBC and elsewhere is when journalists are so busy waving flags, they don't have the energy to do their jobs, which is to ask the questions before the bombs start flying.
What do you think of MSNBC host Keith Olbermann now? You wrote a piece, Is Olbermann on Thin Ice? He is speaking out vociferously.
Right. Olbermann is an exception to the rule, like we were briefly. Media activists have got to be on guard. I know FAIR is on guard. I know Media Matters for America is on guard. Olbermann is the top-rated show on MSNBC. His ratings are booming because he does independent journalism. But he's got the same management. And the owner of MSNBC, we should have mentioned, is General Electric, makes a lot of money from war. I know these management people. What's changed for Olbermann, the reason he's possible, is the political zeitgeist has changed. Politics has changed. This upcoming election is one of the most important in years, and politics may really change. That's what's helping Olbermann. But if things went the other way, and somehow the conservatives were on the ascent again, if you're working at a big corporate media outlet, they don't let you kick the conservatives if they're up. The only time you get a chance at the conservatives is when they're down. And it's important that the political zeitgeist change and continue to change in a progressive direction, and then the Obermans get a little support. But if anything were to happen to Olbermann, the media activism movement, Amy, is so much stronger now than when they were suppressing us at Donahue years ago. A lot has changed in 4 years, and one of the real changes in the environment is media activism is stronger. Internet activism is stronger. Olbermann is ready to be supported in a way people weren't even getting the news that Donahue needed support. Donahue's being muzzled. It's a great change in the last few years.
Also, I mean, just in terms of a business decision, Olbermann's doubled his audience as the highest rate.
But we could have doubled our audience. They knew that. They wouldn't let us double our audience. They were less interested in us ramping up our ratings than in tamping down our content before the war. Remember, when Donahue was on the air, Bush's popularity was pretty high. The war was just coming. Now the war is in a shambles, and Bush's popularity is very low. That's giving Olbermann the breathing room, and I commend him. I think he's doing a great job.
A Reuters editor might have lost his job for writing the book Brainless, The Lies and Lunacy of Ann Coulter, according to the New York Times. On Tuesday, Joe McGuire, one of two editors in charge of markets coverage at Reuters, handed his bosses the galleys of his new book. And on Wednesday, McGuire discovered he would have plenty of free time to promote his book. Neither side in this dispute would say that he was fired.
Right. Well, look. I mean, I was on the inside. People get terminated for political reasons, and they say it's ratings. But the word got out that Donahue was the highest-rated show. We should say that one thing that's changed is something that FAIR brought about. I mean, this intensified media activism, the boom in independent media, the boom in a media reform movement that's going to be gathering in Memphis in January, it's in some ways because FAIR 20 years ago started. And we're celebrating, shall I mention real quickly, we're celebrating our 20th birthday tomorrow night at Cooper Union, the Great Hall in New York City, for anyone who's in this area. Amy Goodman's going to speak, Barbara Ehrenreich, the great cartoonist, Tom Tomorrow, Deepa Fernandez, you name it, they're going to be there celebrating FAIR tomorrow night at Cooper Union. And that's a big thing. I mean, Olbermann knows that part of his audience, it's the web-based audience. He says something last night, and it's all over the web this morning. And it's really a new thing. And, you know, by the way, when I was at Donahue, I kept talking to management. I said, look, Amy Goodman has moved from radio to TV. She's booming. Daily Coast, these new blogs, they're booming. Let us be the 1 hour on TV that offers a dissenting view on the war, and our ratings will boom. But they were less interested in ratings when Donahue was at MSNBC than in their fear of the content of letting Phil Donahue be Phil Donahue.
What about when you were on Fox? Did you face the kind of pressure you did on MSNBC?
That's the irony. I was on a weekend show. I was on their media criticism show. I got away with more at Fox News than in MSNBC. People assume I was fired at Fox News because they know my progressive views. I left voluntarily because I was sure I would get a better forum for my views at a more middle-of-the-road channel like MSNBC, which was managed by NBC News, the top news division in television. And, you know, I immediately went over at MSNBC. I'd heard so much about the liberals that inject their politics into the news. I went searching for the liberal media there. I found about seven liberals. I'm including the camera operators, the makeup artists, and the interns. No, it was a mistake. At Fox News, I did blast Murdoch and Fox News repeatedly. I had special leeway being on the weekend. They would never have let the show be Hannity and Cohen. I remember times that people went up to Hannity and said, are you afraid of Jeff Cohen? Why don't you have a real debate? Instead of Hannity and Cohen, it's Hannity and Cohen. And of course, it wasn't going to happen. You can't represent the left. This is a rule, CNN, Fox, MSNBC. You can't represent the left every night on American TV if you're actually on the left.
We're going to leave it there. Jeff Cohen, founder of FAIR, his new book is called Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Mate, and Jen Utes. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. We look forward to seeing people tonight at the University of Buffalo at the Slee Theater. I'll be there at 5 o'clock. Then tomorrow night at Cooper Union, 20th anniversary of FAIR. On Friday, I'll be with Steve Earle in Tucson at the Rialto Theater. And then we head to Pittsburgh and Cleveland on Saturday, Washington, D.C. Sunday, back in New York next week. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.